From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now!
I hope violence cannot eliminate by violence, another violence. So the only long-term alternative is through nonviolence.
A week after the New York Times reports the Dalai Lama backed the U.S. invasion of Iraq, we'll let the Tibetan Buddhist monk speak for himself. A new investigation into the death of British reporter Terry Lloyd in Iraq says he was killed by the strafing of a U.S. helicopter gunship. And the California gubernatorial debate. Among those debating, Arianna Huffington versus Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Jobson, it's completely hypocritical of Arnold
Arianna,
to come here and let me finish.
About the
let me finish.
Right now, not about
let
education.
Me finish. You know, this is completely impolite. This is the way you treat women. We know that, but not now.
On that point, excuse me. Excuse me. Candidates, please let me take control of this for a moment. I'm going to decide, as the privilege of the moderator, that that was a direct and personal attack on Mr. Schwarzenegger. So would you respond?
I would just like to say that I just realized that I have a perfect part for you in Terminator 4. That's
it. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The early draft of U.S. Weapons Inspector David Kaye in Iraq has found no weapons of mass destruction. Kaye has led the CIA-backed search for the past 4 months. His team of 1,400 searched suspected sites and interviewed Iraqi scientists. Sections of the report are expected to be released to the public this month. The Times reports that the CIA has emphasized this is just an interim report, apparently in an attempt to minimize political fallout from the findings. Kaye's already returned from Iraq and is working out of CIA headquarters. Just 3 weeks ago, Secretary of State General Colin Powell told NBC's Meet the Press that Kaye's report would show people, quote, that there was no question that such weapons existed, and so did the programs to develop one. Akilah al-Hashimi of the Iraqi Governing Council has died. 5 days ago, she was ambushed, and men armed with machine guns shot her in the stomach and bombed her convoy. It was the first assassination of a member of the U.S.-appointed council. She was one of three women on the 25-person council. In Baghdad, a bomb exploded this morning inside the hotel complex, which houses NBC news offices. The BBC reported the attack marked the first time that Western media had been targeted since Baghdad fell. One person, a Somali security guard, died in the blast. Meanwhile, in Mosul, two people died when a porn cinema was bombed. Up to 20 people were injured. President Bush's problems at the United Nations continued yesterday when he ended 2 days of meetings without receiving international support for more troops or money in Iraq. This according to the Washington Post. Peter Pace, the vice chair of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, warned yesterday this may force the National Guard and Reserve to activate 15,000 to 20,000 more troops. There are about 144,000 U.S. forces in Iraq, 14,000 from Britain and 8,000 from other countries. Meanwhile, the Washington Post reports UN Secretary General Kofi Annan is considering the total withdrawal of UN personnel from Iraq following two bomb attacks at UN's Baghdad headquarters. 27 Israeli pilots have signed a letter to the Israeli Air Force stating they will not take part in, quote, illegal and immoral strikes in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. The letter read in part, quote, we, veteran pilots and active pilots alike, are opposed to carrying out illegal and immoral attacks of the type carried out by Israel in the territories. It continues, we, who have been educated to love the state of Israel, refuse to take part in Air Force attacks in civilian population centers. We refuse to continue harming innocent civilians. Meanwhile, Israeli troops killed four Palestinians during a raid in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. Five Israeli soldiers were also injured. A Nigerian court today blocked the execution of a woman who'd been ordered to be stoned to death for adultery. Human rights groups around the world had protested Nigeria's handling of the case of Amina Lawal, the 31-year-old illiterate woman who was set to be stoned to death because she had a baby 10 months after a divorce. In environmental news, scientists are reporting global warming has caused the largest ice shelf in the Arctic to split in two for the first time since its formation 3,000 years ago. And the Houston Chronicle's reporting a top executive from Halliburton has been appointed to be the new senior advisor to the Iraqi oil ministry. The man, Robert McKee III, is the chair of the Houston-based Inventure Global Technology, an oil field joint venture owned by Shell and Halliburton, the oil services company formerly headed by Vice President Dick Cheney, that has received billions of dollars in contracts in rebuilding Iraq. Dick Cheney still receives a check from Halliburton. Congressmember Henry Waxman of California, one of Halliburton's chief critics, said, quote, "Given Mr. McKee's close relationship with Halliburton, he's an odd choice to hold them accountable for the billions of dollars they're charging American taxpayers." Halliburton has also become the target of roadside signs put up by people opposed to the U.S. occupation. The new website, NobodyDied.com, has started posting photos of some of these anti-war roadside signs. One reads, "Dear America, thanks for all the money. Sorry about your kids. Halliburton Oil." And finally, in California, the five leading gubernatorial recall candidates debated last night for the first time. They sparred on immigration, taxes, the recall, President Bush, and education. We'll have more on that in a few minutes. Being Kind to All by Nawang Ketchag from the Tibetan album Rhythms of Peace. You are listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. His Holiness the 14th, the Dalai Lama Tenzin Gyatso, is the head of state and spiritual leader of the Tibetan people. Born to a peasant family, he was recognized at the age of two as the reincarnation 13th Dalai Lama. At the age of 15, the Dalai Lama was called upon to assume full political power as the state head of state and government after some 80,000 Chinese soldiers invaded Tibet. China has occupied Tibet ever since. In 1954, at the age of 19, the Dalai Lama was negotiating with China's Mao Zedong over the future of Tibet. After years of failed peace talks and a violent suppression of Tibet's resistance movement in which tens of thousands of Tibetans died, the Dalai Lama fled in 1959 to India, where he continues to be the spiritual leader of Tibet's people and heads Tibet's government in exile. Some 80,000 Tibetan refugees followed him into exile. Today, there are more than 120,000 Tibetans in exile. In the early years of exile, the Dalai Lama appealed to the United Nations. In successive years, the General Assembly adopted three resolutions calling on China to respect the human rights of Tibetans and their desire for self-determination. In 1989, the Dalai Lama was awarded the Nobel Peace Prize for his work on global human rights and his ceaseless efforts to free his country from Chinese rule. As he accepted the prize, he referred to himself as, quote, a simple monk from Tibet. Well, this week, the Dalai Lama was in New York. He has been here for more than a week, the last stop of a U.S. tour where he met with Tibetan exiles in several cities and pressed the Tibetan cause in Washington. The New York Times headline was, Dalai Lama says terror may need a violent reply. Dalai Lama doesn't rule out violence to fight terror. Well, the next day, the Dalai Lama's representative sent a letter to the New York Times in response. The Times had said he supported the invasion of Iraq, or that we would have to wait to see what the outcome was. In the letter, his representative said that the Times, quote, gives the misleading impression His Holiness is endorsing violence as a way to confront terrorism. I am sure, as many of your readers are aware, His Holiness has always advocated nonviolence as the most effective method for dealing with conflict, more specifically with regard to the war in Iraq. His Holiness has publicly issued a statement expressing his opposition to war as the momentum was building towards an invasion. On Tuesday, the town hall in New York, I had the rare opportunity to be part of a dialogue with the Dalai Lama. I sat with him and Katrina Vandenhoevel, editor of The Nation magazine, and the actor and activist Susan Sarandon. I asked him about his views on Iraq and also talked about September 11th. Talked about how September 11th united us with people around the world who were subject to terror all too often as a result of U.S.-backed military regimes, as in Guatemala, as in Chile, the September 11th, 1973, 30 years ago, when Salvador Allende was killed in the palace as the U.S.-backed Pinochet regime rose to power. He responded.
Utilizing that freedom, freedom of speech, freedom of thought. I don't think the next week,
I'm sure that as a result of our airing these criticism in public here, there will not be an immediate kind of retribution that we will suffer, say, at least in the next week or so.
I don't think. In any case, I'm leaving tomorrow.
After he talked about freedom of speech in this country, he then began to elaborate his views on the invasion of Iraq. He spoke English, he spoke in Tibetan, and he also was translated. This is the Dalai Lama.
One of the most unfortunate facts of today's world, even to this day, is that still there's some vestiges of old way of dealing with the world, which is to use the threat of force, and including military force, in dealing with on the level of international relations.
That is very unfortunate. Very often, I sort of share with people, with audience, like America, as far as domestic policy is concerned, generally speaking, you are very much cherishing democracy. But in the field of international relations, that democratic principle is not there. Still relying on show of force. And that's backward. But at the same time, you can't blame America. The whole, I think they, some kind of using force by dictatorship, authoritarian, or democratically elected government, at least they use force by elected democratic government is much better. We suffer a lot under undemocratic, authoritarian system.
The Dalai Lama speaking in New York. He then went on to talk about September 11th and his response to the attacks in New York and Washington, D.C. His immediate response being a letter to President Bush. This is the Dalai Lama speaking in New York.
Aeroplane, passenger aeroplane, are hitting. At that time, I got the feeling, oh, human brain and modern technology used by human hatred. Oh, then terrible destructions. So as a Buddhist practitioner, my blame goes directly here, hatred. Now then, after then I wrote a letter to President Bush. I'm terribly sorry. Condolences. And many people killed, died. And many of their relatives, how much they feel, how much pain. Very clear, very obvious. So I express my condolences to the president. And meantime, I also sort of express I hope violence cannot eliminate by violence, another violence. So the only long-term alternative is through non-violence. I expressed. So in fact, at that time, when I dictate a letter, secretary, a little reservation. Then I thought, oh, okay, this is my principle, my basic sort of belief. So, okay. I thought, oh, President Bush, American president, certainly understand my view. I will not put in prison. God's will run you over sometimes.
One of His Holiness's aides suggested probably this is not the right, thing that president would want to listen.
Yeah,
to.
There's so many, so much shock, so much sort of emotions at that time, at such period,
So the aide suggested that given that the whole of America, including the president, is experiencing such shock, that maybe the statement that His Holiness was requesting the president not to to respond violence with another violence may not be the most appropriate thing to do. But His Holiness felt that the president will understand that this is his personal view and hope. And in any case, there is no danger of him being imprisoned.
The Dalai Lama speaking in New York this week about September 11th, about the invasion of Iraq, about the issue of freedom of speech. He also talked about Saddam Hussein and how it was important to understand how Saddam Hussein came to power and maintained that power. This is the Dalai Lama.
It is unfair to blame everything on Saddam Hussein. Saddam Hussein, without his powerful army, he can't be dictator. Without sort of without military sort of sophisticated weapons, it's impossible to build a powerful army. So these weapons not produced in Iraq itself, but come from West. And one time, when Lebanon civil war was going on, I met one French lady. She told me, one side, people, innocent people, killing. One side, some business, making business, selling weapons, bullets. If you truly sort of analyze the how developed this is one dictatorship, many causes, conditions, including Western nations' own contribution. So that's my view. Now, since it's such sort of complex, it is easy to eliminate one person or small group of people. But unless carry that kind of method to realistically, without emotion, possibly more compassionate, more wisdom, eliminate 10 people, it creates 100 people. 100 people eliminate 1,000 people. This will go. So the real method, personal contact, person to person, face to face, talk. At that time, I also expressed the Bin Laden also have a lot of reasons to complain. Now listen, his view, what is his complaint? And the terrorism is because of mutual suffering. They also suffer. Right? So therefore, meet, listen, talk, and try to find a way to solve which causing their complaint. That's the proper way. That's the human way. So therefore, after Iraq war started, before the war started, some people from Europe, also America, asked me, I should go back that and do something. And I thought, in a Muslim capital, a Buddhist monk go there? I don't know. What kind of sort of the result? I don't know. I think good excuse about my selfish feeling, maybe. If I go there, something happened, then no use. But I think realistically speaking also, how much effect if I go? Whether Iraqi government gives me permission or not, that also question. So because of that experience, then I felt, there's some sort of respected people, including Nobel laureate, as a group, and should take more active role on behalf of humanity, not this government or that government or United Nations. Simply, warm heart, with sense of, the responsibility of humanity and group. think, go there as a group. I'm willing to join. If other few more, then I can go. Oh, I can go. And also, I think easier to get permission. So that I really feel regret did not happen. Some representative, government, or even United Nations, I think, unfortunately, now you see many people, too much suspicion, distrust. Mm-hmm. So therefore, you see, they're very difficult. So there's some individual who really people looks no political agenda or interest, then I think there is some ground trust. Then listen first their view and explain. If war started, what benefit? So that's my view about the Iraq war.
We have to. Thank you, Your Holiness. Thank you. We have to break now for take a midday break. Mm-hmm. And we have to take a midday break now. And then I want to thank you all for your wonderful statements. And when Your Holiness goes with Desmond Tutu and Nelson Mandela and Jimmy Carter and all of these people in the nonviolence SWAT team, Amy will cover you. Amy Goodman will go with you with the microphone. Remember that Gandhiji. We have to remember that when Gandhi took the salt marches, when Gandhi went wherever, there was always the reporters who were taking the photograph to have effect. Mm-mm. Because the moral force has to expand to the larger community to really have the effect. So thank you, Amy, and thank you, Katrina. Thank you, Susan.
Thank you much.
Thank you, Holly.
And that was Robert Thurman, professor of Indo-Tibetan Buddhist Studies at Columbia University and director of Tibet House, which sponsored the event at New York's Town Hall, The Dialogue with the Dalai Lama. I was on the panel with Susan Sarandon and Katrina Vandenhoevel of The Nation magazine. The Dalai Lama explaining his views on violence and the invasion of Iraq. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Also, on our website, you'll be able to hear more of his comments, the Dalai Lama speaking for himself. You're listening to Democracy Now! We'll be back with the gubernatorial debate in California. Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Last night, voters in California witnessed the first debate that featured the five leading candidates running to replace Governor Gray Davis, if he's recalled, on October 7th. The candidates had held debates before, but it was the first one that Republican actor Arnold Schwarzenegger agreed to participate in. And it's the one that the questions were given to the candidates in advance. Those who were debating were Cruz Bustamante, who is the lieutenant governor of California, Tom McClintock, a Republican gubernatorial candidate, as well as Arnold Schwarzenegger, Arianna Huffington, the author, independent gubernatorial candidate, and Peter Miguel Camejo, the Green gubernatorial candidate. The debate began with the moderator, Stan Statham, president of the California Broadcasters Association, asking the candidates about their views on the recall.
We get to the first voter question. I thought of something, and I'd like each one of these candidates to do hopefully a quick response to what I think is a really interesting question. And the question is this: what do you think of this recall, Mr. Schwarzenegger?
I think that it is a great idea, and I thank God every day that we have Hiram Johnson that created this more than 90 years ago. His intention was to create this recall because of special interests controlling politicians, and this is exactly what is the case today. And 1.6 million people have signed the recall petition. They basically have said we are mad as hell and we're not going to take it anymore. And 60% of the people have said in the polls that they want to have a recall. So it is terrific. The people's will is being acted out.
Thank you. Let's take this question just down the line, but from this point forward, jump in after the question is first answered. Senator McClintock.
Well, the recall is there so that the people can correct a mistake that was made at the ballot box. Our entire form of government is based on the assumption that more than half the people are right more than half of the time. That doesn't mean that every now and then they're not entitled to make a mistake. And the re-election of Gray Davis and the course that he has taken this state down was a mistake, and it must be corrected. We cannot afford to go down this road another 3 years that has led our state to the brink of bankruptcy. And despite the highest percentage of personal income being spent in the history of California, less to show than any administration in the history of California.
Mr. Camejo.
This recall exists because we have a crisis in California. There's no question that in the last 5 years, we had the highest income the state has ever had. And instead of ending up with a surplus, we ended up with this disastrous deficit. The polls have taken the governor, Governor Davis, down to 22%, and that can't be done by the Republicans alone. They were only 35% of the registered voters. So we do have a crisis here. And this election is the worst election we've ever had and the best election we've ever had. Why the best? Because the public has really gotten a chance to hear and see more than two points of view, to all of a sudden have two candidates here who are not Democrats or Republicans. And it's the worst because we don't have a runoff system. We have no way for the will of the electorate to
Thank
be directly
you.
Registered.
Thank you. If we can make this as quickly as possible. Arianna Huffington, what do you think of the recall?
Well, I'm troubled by the fact that Darrell Issa could spend close to $2 million to collect signatures, paid signature gatherers. There are a lot of elements which are troubling. But nevertheless, there is an unprecedented, historic opportunity here to elect an independent, progressive governor on a simple plurality. And the state desperately needs that because the two-party political system is broken, and that opportunity will not come again in a hurry.
All right. The Lieutenant Governor, Cruz Bustamante.
I think the recall is a terrible idea. I think it's bad for democracy. I think it's bad for our state. I know people right now who are organizing to recall the next governor if it's a Republican. I think that's a bad way of doing politics. I think it's a perpetual type of politic. You know, I agree with my colleagues that there's some good that could come from this as a result. But I think that to do it in this way, even Hiram Johnson, as Arnold talked about in terms of him creating the recall process, even in his inaugural address said that it wasn't the panacea. The recalls are not the panacea for government. I really think that we have a situation here that we have to deal with in terms of the budget crisis. That's true. And we have to deal with that. But this recall could end up being an era of perpetual politics. I think could be bad for California.
Thank you.
An excerpt of the debate last night in Sacramento. As part of the debate format, the California Broadcasters Association pre-recorded questions from voters. The candidates were then given the questions in advance. Several of the questions involve the state's budget and taxes. We will hear now from Republican candidate Arnold Schwarzenegger.
Another shot at this.
Yeah, I don't understand the whole thing. So what you're saying is that the politicians make a mistake. They keep spending and spending and spending.
That's right.
And then when they realize they made a mistake and they spent money they don't even have, then they go out and go and tax, tax, tax. That's the answer to the problem.
In fact, when I was speaker,
we provided a middle-income tax cut. What you have to do is you put a spending cap on it.
We also provided tax cuts.
You guys have an addiction problem. Yes. You should go to an addiction place because you cannot stop spending. So what happens then is if you spend, then you have tax, tax, tax. And then all of a sudden you say, where are the jobs? Gone. Right. That's the problem that we're facing here.
All right, thank you.
Hang on, right here. What do you got, Ariana?
Just one second. Short.
Because this Arnold's analysis fits perfectly the Bush administration in Washington. They keep spending.
You keep talking about Bush. If you want to campaign against Bush,
no,
go to New Hampshire.
You know what? I want
go
you.
Go to New Hampshire.
No.
It's the perfect place for you. You're in the wrong state right now.
You know what? Because otherwise it's so hypocritical
and
for
maybe
you.
Maybe a little bit more decaf.
But Arnold,
no,
it is amazing.
No, you know what?
It is amazing that you will not say, you will never say, that the wealthiest people should at least pay the same tax rate as the average person. You will never say those words. And in fact, you've been raising the taxes in California on the poorest people who pay the highest tax rate. And I'm the only candidate saying cut taxes on 60% of our people that are overpaying. I'm the only one who says it. But I want the rich to pay their fair share. And neither Tom or Arnold will say it. All you got to say is, yes, Peter, you're right. The rich should have to pay the same amount as the average person. All
right. Neither Republican Arnold Schwarzenegger nor Tom McClintock would answer the Green candidate's question, Peter Camejo. While most of the debate focused on California issues, independent candidate Arianna Huffington repeatedly commented on the impact of the Bush administration's economic policies on California voters.
Car tax. But I want to return to something very important, because the people of California need somebody who is going to fight the Bush administration for them. Because you know what? Let me just tell you the facts. The repeal of the estate tax alone is costing us over $3 billion.
We're starting the clock. We have 2 minutes left on this.
Yes,
we're starting the clock. 2 minutes left on the budget.
Great. Well, there is a huge connection between our budgetary problems here and the decisions made in Washington. And we need somebody who is going to fight for properly funded mandates, whether it's in education or in health care, and who is going to fight the administration when they are basically costing us jobs. And it's completely hypocritical of Arnold
Arianna,
to come here and let me finish.
Let me finish.
You know, this is completely impolite. This is the way you treat women. We know that, but not now.
On that point, excuse me. Candidates, please let me take control of this for a moment. I'm going to decide, as the privilege of a moderator, that was a direct and personal attack on Mr. Schwarzenegger. So would you respond?
I would just like to say that I just realized that I have a perfect part for you in Terminator 4. That's it.
And after the debate, in the post-debate press conference, Arianna Huffington said, "Did you see Arnold go after any men tonight the way he went after me? The one woman on the panel was treated differently." She suggested there was an underlying aggression in Schwarzenegger's Terminator 4 reference because he'd spoken with enthusiasm this summer about the prospect of ramming a female robotic rival's head into a toilet in Terminator 3. So we go to our last clip of today in the gubernatorial recall candidates debate.
Ultimately, thanks, Senator. Now, I've thought of something to make this a whole lot more controversial in the area of health care. So why don't each one of you tell us how much money you think the state of California should spend on health care for the kids of illegal immigrants? Who wants to go?
I'll go.
Go ahead, Mr. Sure. Bustamante.
I'd be more than happy to deal with that particular issue, because I think that, you know, the one thing you shouldn't do, Stan, just sort of in life, is take it out on the kids. You know, I mean, it's not their fault that their parents are here, but let's put that to the side for just a minute. The people who are here, you know, I know that sometimes people think that their food comes from, you know, Safeway or Ralph's But it really doesn't. It comes from 70% of the people who pick our fruit and our food and put it on our table are these immigrants. They're also the same people who work hard every single day. They pay their taxes. They stay out of trouble with the law. 30% of the construction, 40% of the hotels. All these folks who are here, who are working, they're taking care of their families, they're paying taxes. You know, for them not to be able to have a driver's license or to be able to put their kids into school, I think is just wrong.
I don't appreciate the demonstration, but it's certainly heartfelt. Peter Camejo.
Yes, well, I just want to say that the people we're talking about are the lowest paid workers in California who work the hardest, who pay taxes and receive almost no benefits. They are essential to our economy. We loosely use this word, I think totally inappropriate, illegal. No one's going to arrest them. If somebody's illegal, you arrest them. But no one's going to arrest them because they're essential for California, and everybody knows they're here to stay. They're part of our family. We have to end this apartheid system that we have towards them. They are part of our community, essential to our economy. I really object to this term illegal. I mean, you know, in the first debate I referred to who came over here totally illegally, and it was European Americans who came over here. And, you know, but they're here, so give them a driver's license. Give them their rights. I'm not going to object to that. But these are the children of the indigenous people of this continent. Let's understand that if your economic situation was the same as theirs, you'd do exactly the same thing. People all over the world are moving through borders to try to feed their families. Let's look at this as a human problem we face, not a thing of criminality. These are part of our family. We need to help them and work with them and give them medical insurance. And the cost that it will come about, they are paying for it because right now they're contributing to our tax base.
Thank you. And I know, thank you. Ladies and gentlemen, this is a political debate, and I have good news for you. If you'd like to demonstrate, it only takes $20 and a California Highway Patrol license fee, and they'll give you a location outside the Capitol building, and you can enjoy yourself. Try to restrain your applause, please. I know that Arnold Schwarzenegger has a strong opinion on this issue, so what is it?
Well, first of all, I think it is important that we take care of our children. And we have to make sure that every child in California is insured. That is the most important thing, because I'm very passionate about children's issues. I think we have to take care of our children and we have to take care of our seniors. Good. This is very important because they cannot fend for themselves. The children, we have a healthy family program here in California. And that is a very, very good program. It's supposed to be to ensure people to get health care for children and also for their parents if they are low-income people. The only problem with the program right now is that only two-thirds of the people that are eligible are not having that health care. And because the government has not done a good job in reaching out and finding the people and letting them know to sign up and to find easy ways for them to sign up, two-thirds of the people that are eligible do not have the health care. And so that is really terrible. If I become governor here, I would immediately go out there and promote that. Promote it and market it in such a way and get it out there so everyone knows about it and everyone signs up, because we must ensure our families, the low-income families, and especially the children.
Well, on that, we do agree.
Ariana, go ahead.
I'm very glad that Arnold is in favor of providing health care for the children of illegal immigrants. That's really good news, because after all, you did vote for 187. And also, I'm really glad that you say that, because you've also come out against licenses for undocumented immigrants. So there is a bit of a contradiction here. In fact, I was really saddened that you as an immigrant would come out against giving that basic right to immigrants here who are trying to drive, to go to work, to take their kids to school. You know, it's all very well to say you are for children, you want them to be insured, but if their parents cannot legally drive them to work in a way that they are insured and they are safe, isn't that a bit of a contradiction?
And well, Ariana, again, as usual, you're off here. We're talking about health care and you're talking about driver's license. But
they are connected.
Let me answer that quickly.
Because parents drive their children.
Let me just tell you, I am against the driver's license because it is without any background check and without any fingerprints or anything. Therefore, it is dangerous for the security of California. Governor Davis came out a year ago and has made that clear and has said, you know, we cannot do that because it is endangering us. It is a security problem. And all this now, because of this election coming up on October 7th, now all of a sudden it is a great idea. Let's get some more votes. That is the idea of those things. It is wrong to do that.
And
And you know that we have a security problem because of it. We have
to, the governor is supposed to
represent the people of California, not special interests. That is the problem.
I think you're all losing sight of a very important fact, and that is we're talking about families that are in this country in violation of our nation's immigration laws. Now, this nation has the most generous immigration policies of any nation in the world.
1 minute.
Illegal immigration undermines that process of legal immigration that's the strength of our nation. There are millions of people who are willing to abide by our immigration laws to come to this nation, become Americans, and see their children grow up and prosper as Americans. Illegal immigration is the process of cutting in line in front of them, and I don't believe that we should be rewarding such behavior. Illegal immigration is costing this state $4 billion in direct costs out of our state treasury by the most conservative estimate available.
30 seconds.
We have got to assure that our immigration laws are enforced. I led the opposition to the measure on giving driver's licenses to illegal immigrants because it undermines the enforcement of our immigration laws.
All right, do you want a quick 15-second close on this, Ariana?
Yes, absolutely. Because you know what? At least the good news about Tom McClintock is you know where he stands. There's no fudging. And that's what I like about you. With Arnold, you know, it's all over the map. You know, we are for taking care of kids, but not for driving them safely to school or to the emergency room or wherever the health care is to be provided. And ultimately, that's the kind of pandering to the Pete Wilson team that you're surrounding yourself with, because ultimately they're not going to change. You know, they don't really fundamentally care for those immigrants,
Ariana,
in this country.
This is identification. There is no background check. It is dangerous for our security
it
here.
It is offensive for you to imply
we have those 2 points.
But let's do it the right way.
We have those
let's
2 points.
Visas.
Arnold,
let's get them temporary
working permits. It is really offensive
permits.
To think that they are terrorists just because they are here
let's
as illegal immigrants.
Ladies and gentlemen, this is not...
Ariana Huffington, Arnold Schwarzenegger, Tom McClintock, Cruz Bustamante, and Peter Miguel Camejo debating in the first gubernatorial debate that Arnold Schwarzenegger has agreed to. The questions were given to the candidates in advance. You are listening to Democracy Now. Our website is democracynow.org. We'll be back in a minute. You're listening to Democracy Now!, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. The U.S. military may be responsible for the death of yet another journalist in Iraq. ITN reporter Terry Lloyd died near Basra on March 22nd, just days after the invasion of Iraq began. It was originally believed Lloyd was shot dead in crossfire between Iraqi troops and U.S. Marines. On September 10th, 6 months after Lloyd's death, a British paper reports he was not killed in crossfire but died later when his vehicle was strafed by a U.S. helicopter gunship that he was being carried to a hospital. An Iraqi businessman named Hamid Aglan told the Daily Mirror of Britain he picked up Lloyd at the scene of the initial ambush and was driving him to a hospital in a civilian minibus when they came under fire from a U.S. helicopter. Lloyd was wounded a second time and was dead on arrival at the hospital in Basra. He was 50 years old. Aglan said, quote, "After the helicopter attack, Lloyd stopped moving and was covered in blood. He was dead when we reached the hospital 10 minutes later. Doctors said he was shot in the head. The helicopter pilot killed him. It shouldn't have happened." He said he told British forces what had happened after the end of the war, but was ignored. Two of Lloyd's colleagues were traveling with him when they got caught in the crossfire. Cameraman Fred Nirak and translator Hussein Osman were never found. Their bodies are still missing. They're presumed dead by colleagues. Well, yesterday I spoke with the General Secretary of the International Federation of Journalists, Aidan White. The IFJ represents more than 500,000 journalists in 100 countries. I asked Aidan White, who's speaking from Brussels, to talk about the treatment of journalists in Iraq and began by asking him about this latest investigation into the killing of Terry Lloyd.
Well, I think the death of Terry Lloyd is really very disconcerting altogether. It's a case which has caused a great deal of concern to journalists all around the world. Here was a camera team working for the British-based ITN, traveling in two clearly marked television vehicles on the road towards Basra when they suddenly saw that there was coming towards them a truck containing Iraqi troops. They immediately turned around and started coming back towards a place where there were American tanks and coalition forces. What happened then is that they were fired upon. First of all, they were caught in the crossfire. They were fired upon by American forces and also fired upon from behind by the Iraqis. And what happened then is really not clear. But Terry Lloyd, who was the journalist leading this team, was wounded in the stomach. And what happened then was that he was injured. He was taken, and a truck was waved down, or a car was waved down, and he was being taken to hospital in Basra when vehicle he was traveling in was shot at by an American helicopter, and then he was fatally wounded. There was every possibility that he was going to survive the initial attack, but this second attack killed him. Now, what's awful about this particular case is that we have had to wait almost 6 months after the event and after this death to actually have the full truth to come out about the case. We're still waiting for an official military investigation to provide a plausible report, that will explain exactly what happened here and why two media vehicles were attacked in broad daylight. That causes us real concern. And there's a whole series of incidents in the Iraqi war in which journalists have been killed, which raise serious questions about whether or not there was willful disregard for the safety of journalists, or even, in fact, if there weren't cases of targeting of journalists by American forces in particular during the war. The Terry Lloyd death and incident is a terrible one, but his case is also overshadowed by the fact that two people who were part of his team, Fred Nirak, a cameraman, Hussein Osman, a translator who was with his team, they completely disappeared. They have never been found. Their bodies have never been found. They've not been traced. There has been no word or explanation about what happened to them at all. And that's a terrible thing for the families, the friends, and the colleagues of these people. We've also had a situation where the Palestine Hotel, which was attacked in central Baghdad, known to be the home for foreign journalists reporting on the conflict, this was attacked. Two journalists were killed. Three were seriously injured. The Pentagon's report into that incident cleared the soldiers who actually fired on the hotel of any responsibility, but did not explain at all why this hotel, which was well known to be the home of up to 200 journalists, had not been declared off limits to all the forces. Indeed, the tank commander who took the decision to fire on the hotel did not know that that hotel contained journalists, but his commanders did know. And the report that has come out from the Pentagon on the attack on the Palestine Hotel is absolutely a cynical whitewash of that event. It is quite clear that there was negligence on the part of the military command in their failure to inform soldiers on the ground that the Palestine Hotel which was quite prominent, a tall building on the Baghdad landscape, contained foreign journalists and should under no circumstances be subject to military attack, but it was. And what's even worse about this particular case is that the American authorities and the spokespersons for the Central Command said that the attack occurred because they had been fired upon by snipers or Iraqi forces from the Palestine Hotel. Yet this was denied completely by all of the journalists who were staying in the Palestine Hotel. And in fact, the evidence is very, very clear. There was no firing at all from the Palestine Hotel on American forces. And yet, American spokespersons, right up to Colin Powell, were saying weeks after this event that they had been fired upon, and yet it was not true. Now, that case is extremely worrying as well. And then there's the case of the attack on the Al Jazeera bureau in Baghdad, where another journalist was killed. Al Jazeera is a controversial network, Arab language network, but they had informed both the Iraqi authorities and the American authorities of the exact coordinates of their buildings, not just in Baghdad, but throughout Iraq, and made it clear that they would give prominence to showing that where they were so that they could avoid an attack. And they were assured that they would not be attacked. And yet, despite that, on April the 8th, there was an attack on the Al Jazeera building, and again, a journalist was killed. And then there's the case of Masandana, a distinguished, award-winning journalist, a cameraman, working for Reuters, who went with a Reuters team into photograph an event around a Baghdad prison. The team asked the American forces who were around the prison what they could do, what they couldn't do. They were told they would be allowed to do some filming from a nearby bridge. They did that. They were moving away from that, and suddenly they were fired upon. They were fired upon from an American tank. Masandana was killed. And this week, just this week, we have had the most disgraceful report produced by the Pentagon of their own investigation into this event, in which they say that the camera that Masandana was carrying on his shoulder was mistaken by their soldiers for a rocket-propelled grenade launcher. And all of the evidence we have from eyewitnesses, because this took place in broad daylight, is that they are incredulous that could be an explanation for what happened here. What's even worse, though, is that the report that's been made by the Pentagon has not even been made public. There's no possibility of anyone independently scrutinizing what took place in that investigation and what that report actually says, because they've refused to reveal the information. So all of these cases, the Terry Lloyd case, the attack on the Palestine Hotel, the attack on Al Jazeera, the death of Masandana, are all unexplained killings of journalists and media staff with completely unacceptable responses by the American authorities. And it all creates an atmosphere of extreme anxiety within journalism.
We've been speaking with Aidan White. He is the General Secretary for the International Federation of Journalists based in Brussels, Belgium. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to get a copy of today's show, you can call 1-800-881-2359. That's 1-800-881-2359. Also today on our website, we'll be featuring the comments of the Dalai Lama on the invasion of Iraq on September 11th. On war. Our website is www.democracynow.org. You can also sign up for our website and Daily Digest there. Democracy Now! Produced by Mike Burke, Sharif Abdul-Qudus, Lenina Nadal, Anna Nogueira, Elizabeth Press, Jeremy Scahill, Pervez Sharma. Mike DeFilippo is our engineer. Our website, democracynow.org. I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for joining us.